Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara. So this afternoon, we have this opportunity to reflect on Dhamma, ultimate reality, the way it is. So I found in my own experience, investigation, ultimate reality is always here and now, timeless. And even though one is told that in the beginning, when one begins this search, this journey, we still think of terms of worldly thoughts, of dualistic thinking. You can't imagine timelessness, akalika dhamma, because imagination, images are all about time. They have form, they're in space. But timelessness throws the thinking mind into a collision. It can't conceive anything. And yet that's where we experience through the senses, through the ayatanas, the six senses, we experience time condition, space and time. So most people's reality is about time, what exists, what is true, what is false, heaven and hell, happiness and suffering. Now the First Noble Truth is suffering. There is suffering. It should be understood. But timelessness doesn't suffer. Akalika Dhamma is blissful, happy. So ultimately you realize your true nature is a happy one, not a limited form in time and space. So that realization, you can't, when you think about it and try to understand it through concepts, through metaphysical thinking, through any technique possible, you can't, it can take you so far, and it can't, you can't reach that ultimate goal of timeless, apparent here and now timelessness. So sometimes Buddhism is mistaken as a kind of pessimistic religion because the First Noble Truth proclaims the experience of suffering, where we don't want suffering, we want happiness. When we think of heaven, or when you think of Nibbana, or enlightenment, we think of happiness. I want to be happy. Happiness is what we want. Suffering is what we don't want. And yet we bind ourselves to conditions that change. The very nature is unsatisfactory. Like one's own body. it just, once it's born, it starts maturing, grows up, gets old, gets sick, and dies. And that's just the reality of a human condition, a human body, or an animal's body, the same thing. So old age, sickness, and death is what we experience, which is suffering for us, because basically none of us want suffering. We want good health, happiness, stability, certainty. We want bliss. And this is all the things that we want. And so we can waste our lives just seeking happiness in conditioned phenomena, in phenomena that is very nature is to change. In relationships, in substances, in drugs, in alcohol, in power, wealth, all kinds of possibilities available to human individuals. If you have a lot of money, then there's a certain stability you might feel. But investigate the lives of multi-billionaires, and they're not particularly impressive in terms of blissful happiness, because power and wealth are very deluding. They change our world to one where we have a lot of fear of loss, suspicion, paranoia. Do people really like me for myself? Or do they just want to get something off me, some kind of favor or money? One can't help thinking like that in the dualistic thought process. So happiness is our real nature. I'm just stating this not to be believed, but just pointing out that Buddhism is not about pessimism, about just saying everything's miserable and suffering. It's to be understood, to understand suffering rather than to try to get rid of it. So suffering is a heavenly messenger, you might say. It's a messenger. It's what we experience because we're attached to something we want that we can't get, or we feel it's being taken away from us. So this is to be reflected upon again and again as we repeat these phrases over and over through our lives as samanas, as meditators. Because Dhamma is apparent here and now and timeless. And then I'd like to ask you, what is apparent here and now? And some of you, most of you probably will start looking around, the shrine, the speaker, the feeling you might have in the present moment. But those are changing. Those are very impermanent, unstable things, phenomena, changing, unstable, unsatisfactory. But what every one of you is experiencing and what you really are apparent here now is you know you're conscious. But you see consciousness in a very personal way. You take it very personally. I'm conscious. I can be unconscious. When I sleep, I'm not conscious. And when I die, then consciousness goes to some other realm, goes to maybe if we lived a virtuous life, to a heavenly realm. If we've lived an unvirtuous life, a wicked life, then we go the opposite direction into the hell realms. But none of that is apparent here and now. Heaven and hell are just ideas, concepts we've created about the best and the worst that we can experience through these sensitive forms. So like heaven is where you have a body still, but it's made of ether, it's not so coarse. It's a beautiful body, and you experience unmitigated happiness and bliss for 84,000 eons. So like in scriptural texts, 84,000 eons sounds pretty good. You know, if you make merit, do a lot of good, help others, are kind and generous, moral, responsible for what you say and do. And so this can lead you, you can expect when your body passes on that your consciousness will go to some ideal heavenly state of where you'll be in a state of unmitigated bliss for 84,000 eons. So what is that really when I'm talking like this? Is it's imagining. That's what it is. The words 84,000 eons are just words that arise and cease in the present. Bliss is what we imagine to be extremely wonderful kind of happiness, blissed out of our minds, bliss and permanent for at least for 84,000 eons. And so we can convince ourselves, we can believe in these concepts. And so we do, we believe in concepts that are created by unenlightened human beings trying to explain the mystery of life. And then fear is of hell going to, what if you've done something wrong? What if you stole an apple from the nature's orchard when you were 10 years old? What if you committed adultery? Or what if you spoke badly to your wife or husband, or on and on like that? There's incredible kind of experiences we remember where we were not very good, not at our best, maybe at our worst. So all these concepts of at my best, I've tried to live a good life and be a good person, I should be rewarded for that. But then there's also the fear of who knows what the day of judgment, where you'll be sent. And you can imagine anything. Reincarnation might include reincarnating in a lower state, some kind of fish or turtle, spider. I mean, it's possible, you can imagine that, a kind of a metamorphosis where your consciousness, when your body dies, goes to an animal realm. And you can believe that. So believing is what we do. We tend to believe in things that we haven't proved. We have no real factual evidence for, such as heaven and hell, such as the self-view, the personality. Are you really a personality? You know, is when you start looking at your personality, being a witness to it, it changes. I have no idea what Ajahn Sumedho is like as a person, because it changes according to conditions. But I know consciousness is like this. It's apparent here and now, and it's timeless, and it's happy. It's free, liberated from the bondage of thinking, emotions, the limitations of forms, karma, etc. So nibbana, the word nibbana, you know, when you hear this word, this is a Pali Buddhist word, and we imagine it's a very desirable state. When we ordain, we say to realize nibbana. We ordain to realize nibbana. And of course, we see that in a person. Will I, Ajahn Sumedho, realize nibbana? And so, you know, we see it in personal terms of I'm ordaining as a Buddhist monk, and I'm ordaining to realize nibbana is ceremonial wordage. But can a person realize nibbana? You know, that's a question to ask yourself. And so this is investigating how we believe in concepts, words, theories, doctrines. And so there's so many theories going around, conspiracy theories and beliefs in various concepts of good and evil and right and wrong. And the news media and the internet and all this promote this, all these kind of possibilities. And so we try to are these conspiracies? Can we believe them or don't believe them? Some of them seem reasonable, make sense. Some of them seem absolutely absurd. Yet there's always somebody who will believe even the most absurd theories, because they don't know any better. They're caught in the web of delusion, and they want to be told, if you follow me, if you do what I say, if you do this and that, and then you will be rewarded with power, wealth, happiness. But if you know consciousness is apparent here and now and timeless, then theories of any sort really are unnecessary. You get beyond theorizing, imagining, just, you know, reasonable theories or totally absurd theories, doesn't make any difference. Because what we can realize is Dhamma here and now, which is timeless. It's not a theory, it's reality, ultimate reality. So that doesn't change. That's not anicca, that's not impermanent, it's not suffering, it's not separate self. So I encourage you all to take your stand in this awareness, in what we call mindfulness or awareness, conscious awareness. It's what we call the gate or the door to the deathless, to ultimate reality, to nirvana. It's how we are trapped within these mortal forms can realize the deathless reality for ourselves and not just be caught in believing in Buddhist ideas of nirvana, no matter how profound or beautiful they might seem. In the monastic life, you know, you're living in a structure that's very traditional. So it dates back, we assume, to 2,565 years, originating in India. So that is a tradition or form, it's a phenomenon, but is just grasping the phenomenon itself should be, you know, is advisable. But eventually the phenomenon becomes just empty phenomena like all other phenomena. You get beyond the structures, the traditions, the whether they're ancient or modern psychological theories, science, physics, all that has been created and promoted in the human realm, to ultimate reality, to a real refuge in consciousness, apparent here and now, timeless. And then ehi prasiko is the invitation, come and see for yourself. Don't take my word for it. So this is what is so elegant about this particular tradition, is that it is, you know, the encourager to investigate life and experience, to find out for yourself, which means when you realize the timeless reality here and now, and then the time-bound conditions are no longer, you no longer cling to them. You still have to experience the aging process of a human body and the problems that creates and the diminishing of the senses and so forth, because that's part of what the body does. But the escape hatch into ultimate reality is through awareness, through investigation, sati and sampajanya, to really, and this encouragement to investigate. I found a real challenge because, you know, it gave me the kind of right to investigate life rather than just be caught in becoming a Buddhist monk in the Theravada Thai forest tradition, just changing my conditions to Buddhist ones from other ones that I was before that. So it's not just putting on a robe, wearing another costume, shaving the head, but it is the encouragement to wake up and find out for yourself. And Lungpa Cha always used to say in Thai, in budget tongue is the Pali word for to be realized for yourself. So the experience of a human being is life is in terms of personal, you know, a personal experience. You can't get what you want just through willpower. You suffer when you can't get what you want. But you can investigate. You can observe wanting to get something you don't have is like this. That kind of witnessing is Buddha, knowing Dhamma. It's only a Buddha can know Dhamma. So as long as one personally identified in these separate forms believes in oneself as a personality, then of course you can believe you realize Dhamma, but that's not it. You can believe you're an arahant, or you can believe that you're not an arahant. You can believe that you're a stream enterer. These are words. Or you can believe that you haven't attained stream entry yet. Sotapanna, you know. So then you think of my meditation. I've been meditating for so many years, I should be a stream enterer by now. This is thinking, isn't it? It's about what I want that I'm not sure that I have, or maybe you convince yourself that you are. But as long as the self-view dominates, I'm a stream enterer, or I'm not a stream enterer, both are concepts created in language, belief systems that we can grasp and then suffer from. Because it's this grasping of these unstable conditions that is the cause of suffering. So the second noble truth is about letting go. That's the advice, to let go of phenomena. And that means just not grasping anymore. It's letting go is like relaxing. It's not like grasping meditation, grasping concepts, Buddhist concepts, grasping the sense of a separate self that has become a Buddhist. Or when we do grasp, then really grasp something and observe it. And just the pronoun, me, I used to love to just recite over and over, me, 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 and it makes, you know, it sounds so utterly selfish. This is my, when I just think about me, how I feel, what I want, me. And I've experienced that as a person. And the suffering that I created in my life through the emphasis on me as a separate person. So just the two-letter pronoun, me, I found very powerful just to investigate it. When I think me, what does it make me feel? Very separate. Because then there's you, you're separate from me. And maybe you're a threat to me. Because other people are not me, so you don't know what they're thinking, what they're planning, what they might be considering to do, whether they love you or hate you. Whatever, you can imagine anything that might affect me. And depending on your kind of karmic inheritance, we obsess ourselves with the sense of me and mine. This is my space. So I'm here and sitting in this seat talking to you from this, say, this is my space. And how does that affect you when I say, this is my space, you can't come here because it's mine? And you realize how, you know, how unpleasant that is to really believe in those concepts. Because space doesn't belong to anybody. Space is apparent here and now. And time, we don't know how it, where space began or ends. It has no possibility for investigating space in terms of something that began and will end. But it is apparent here and now, wherever, whether in your kuti, on the London Underground, on top of a high-rise building, on top of Mount Everest, or here in the sala, space is like this. And there couldn't be Mount Everest or a London Underground or anything without space. Space is an absolute necessity for forms. So just by investigating space, which is apparent here and now and has no beginning or ending that we can observe or objectify, but we observe ourselves. So we think, I'm sitting here and I have a name and all that, and so I'm separate from you. And then the gender differences, male and female, a lot is made of that. And racial differences, age differences, nationality differences, political differences, all these end up in battles, wars, persecution, because we're so concerned about the limitations we're clinging to, we forget. We've lost ourselves in a kind of confused, swirling mess of confusing ideas and concepts, that all of them are empty and meaningless ultimately. And then here and now is silence. Which is always here and now. And it's behind the noise of your mind, the sensitivity of your body, what you think or feel or believe in. Silence is the background behind all the noise of the world, the wars, the conflicts, the problems, personal problems, national problems. The silence is always here and now. And as you take refuge in that silence, because that is apparent here and now, it's like space. You don't create it, because you don't create space, you just, you know, you can perceive space, you can see. I can see the space between me and you, the limits of this temple. But the temple is in space. And I read this morning in the news that some scientists believe that the sun is conscious. This is some kind of new discovery. The sun is conscious. They think it is. And then you think of the sun, consciousness all of its own. My consciousness is sitting here in Amaravatisala. And what is that? It's like separation, isn't it? The sun is way out there. It's a sunny day. We couldn't survive without the sun. And yet we, then we live our lives. We can be sun worshippers. A lot of people believe in sun gods because we know without the sun there'd be nothing left except space and consciousness, or just consciousness. So the sun is in consciousness rather than its consciousness is in the sun. That doesn't make sense. And the consciousness that the sun is in is the same consciousness each one of us is in right now at this moment. But when we think the new discovery, the sun has consciousness, then we think that consciousness is limited inside that big ball of fire. And it has no eyes, ears, nose, tongue. It has a body. But what is the sun thinking? Does it have a language? Has it developed thought or reason? Or, you could imagine anything that some kind of sun god lives there. But who'd condemn any kind of god to live on the sun? It's too hot. So these are concepts that we create around heat and cold, about Mount Everest, high and low, deep into the sea, high on top of the mountain, deep into the ocean. Are the fish in the ocean, whales and dolphins, are they conscious? So we think, well, all human beings are really conscious. There's a kind of conceit amongst human beings that we're conscious and the rest of the world isn't. People ask, are dogs and cats conscious? But the consciousness that a fish, a dog, or a cat is experiencing the same that we're experiencing, apparent here and now and timeless. But as human beings, this species of mammal can reflect on that. The First Noble Truth is giving us a very banal clue on how to do that. It's suffering is the most ordinary human experience that we all share with all other human beings, male or female, whatever race, nationality. We share it with animals. But the gate to the deathless, the door to the deathless reality is open to those who are mindful and aware. And that's because we can reflect. We're not just trapped in a species form that we can't get out of. We can't, we're just caught in the human condition and that's it. We can't have no way of realizing beyond it, but we do. So this is what sati sampajanyam, conscious awareness, is about. It's apparent here and now, timeless. Ehi pasya, wake up and see for yourself. Go inward. Don't seek nibbana as some external ideal place. It's apparent here and now. Ehi pasya, upanayiko bhajatam vaitidapo vinyuhi, to be realized individually. So I offer this as a reflection for today.